Hey everybody, this is Ray Pelsch, and this is episode one of Have Not Seen This, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at a much-beloved movie, selected specifically by our guest, hoping that you have seen it, and if you haven't, maybe our conversation will strike you to do so. Welcome. Man, it is good to be back to podcasting. I have missed it. It's been a little under 6 years since my last podcast silently faded away, and there hasn't been a week that's gone by that I haven't missed doing it, and the last few weeks getting this show prepared and starting to watch movies that guests have picked has been a lot of fun, and I hope that you enjoy the conversations that we have as we dive into some really spectacular movies, some that I've seen before, some that I have not seen until this show. For my first guest, there was really no doubt as to who I was going to pick. You see, when I started my old show, it started as a solo act way back in the beginnings of podcasting, and I quickly realized that people didn't want to just listen to me blather on for an extended period of time, that if the show was going to be any kind of success, I was going to need some co-hosts. And so I invited a friend to come join me for an episode just to try it out, and as it happened, my sister was moving back into town and was around the weekend that we were recording, so I invited her to sit in as well. And people really took to her, and she ended up unintentionally becoming a regular part of the show. In fact, for most of our 300 episodes, she was by my side, making snarky comments and giving her insight into the world of movies. We didn't announce at the time that she was my sister. We could have gone all my brother and me, but instead we decided to keep it a secret, and it wasn't until almost episode 200 that we decided to reveal that she and I were related. But there's really no reason to keep that a secret at this point, and so I turned to her to be my first guest. Since she left the podcast, she has been involved in writing, and as she'll talk about, she has a couple of novels out, and I encourage you to go check those out over on Amazon, and I'll put links to them in the show notes, as well as following her on Twitter or Facebook and finding her other projects that she has going on. I wasn't at all surprised by the movie that she selected, 1979's Alien, because it's been a film that she's loved for a very long time. And we get into the foundation of why that movie is so important to her and its significance for her life. So sit back and enjoy our conversation. Here is episode one of Have Not Seen This, 1979's Alien, with Margaret Telsch Williams. How you been?
So far, so good.
So what do you mean?
Work has been crazy, and I'm just trying to write like crazy when I'm not at work.
Yeah, how do you manage that? Because you're doing a full-time job.
Stealing time here and there. I don't have any like big chunks of time, so I'm just grabbing 30 minutes, you know, hour or whatever.
Right.
So
now you've got two books have come out in the last few months, or just one?
I have a series that is like short story length. There's like four of those. Two have come out. Another one comes out on Tuesday. And then I have the one full novel, Wild Type, that's out.
Okay. I can never tell when you're promoting something that's already out or if it's something new, because I'm just usually skimming through, so I'm not paying close enough attention.
I'm trying to get better about like just saying like, releases today or something like that to make it clear, because I'm trying to do like there's promotions that you can sign up for and there's expectations for how many times you share the promotions if you're included, and if you know everybody shares it with the same amount of people, then you know maybe there's some traction there. So I'm trying to straddle that line between feeling like I'm annoying everybody and fulfilling my share requirements.
I get that. I've never been good at the self-promotion part of things. I look back at like, you know, on this day in Facebook and how many times there's a, hey, we're recording a podcast today. And I'm just like, God, that must have been really annoying to people who didn't care. And I know we had, you know, some people who did, but.
Right. But you know what? That's Facebook used to say, what are you up to? Or what are you doing? Like, that's what we were doing.
Right, right. So
there wasn't really much of a better answer.
That's true. That's true. So you've got that going on through the Patreon?
Well, those are on Amazon, and then I'm also doing Patreon.
Oh, okay.
Short stories as well from there.
Okay. So you're in a couple different places then.
Yeah. And then I've got like what I'm writing right now. So
right.
It's all over the map.
Jeez.
It's like spinning plates.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're having to keep straight. Okay, this is what's actually being published, but this is what I'm currently working on, and this is...
Right.
Of course, I'm sure you also have the ideas for the future type thing as well.
I do, and then like trying to get covers for things, and there's a lot of moving parts. I think I'm just ignorant enough to not be too intimidated by it. But when I look backwards at all the stuff I've already learned, I'm like, holy shit. Like, I don't know.
Now, where are you pulling your artwork from?
I've hired people to do like the cover for Wild Type. And then the next like three things that I'm going to come out, I've purchased covers from people. And then the one that's like the short stories that go make a whole series, those I've made those covers.
And then you also have the advisory, not advisory, that's not the word I want, where you and your friend are doing...
We do critiques and editing, yeah.
Critiques and editing. How's that going?
It's really good. We're in a lull right now, and we're both kind of grateful.
I was going to say, I bet with everything else you've got going on, a lull would be nice.
Exactly. Because we, for like the first year, it was just steady, like nonstop. And then we were talking in, I think, June, and it was like, all right, summer break's coming. Do we want to run an ad, or do we want to have some time? So we chose not to run an ad, which is how we've been getting all of our business. And then we still got contacted by someone that knew someone whose work we had already done. So they had seen like what kind of, you know, return you get. And they hired us, and we've read like two screenplays from them already in our not advertising, not trying to fill up our scheduled time. We still had stuff to read. So
just word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's nice. Good. Yeah, it's good. A little extra change in your pocket, you know.
Right. So. Right. That's a lot to have on your plate.
Yeah. It is.
So where do people? Well, I was going to say where do people find the consulting business, but I guess you don't want to advertise that right now.
No, that's fine. It's twostepapproach.com. TWO. stepapproach.com. And the meaning of it is that it, when somebody, you know, buys a editing, you know, package or whatever, it's that you're getting opinions from both of us. You're not just getting one editor reading your work, you're getting two. And we're very transparent about our pricing as well, which a lot of editing services aren't. So that was important to us to make sure you don't have to email to ask how much it costs.
Cool. And then your Patreon is where?
Patreon.com/ I think it's MT Williams, but it might be M. Telsh Williams. Let me see. MT Williams.
MT, you're hiding the Telsh again, like just the old days of the podcast.
Well, it's full on M. Telsh Williams everywhere else, but when you come to like making a URL, having a hyphenated last name is kind of shitty.
Cool. Well, so you were on the early days of the weekly blend.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't intended to be. You were supposed to be like a one-off, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what kept you coming back? I mean, other than me begging.
You know, I mean, it's fun. It's fun to like just shoot the shit and hang out.
Yeah. So. That was the thing I missed the most when you made the choice to leave, and I totally understood why you were leaving and the timing and everything, but it was like, well, it was nice to have a weekly opportunity to chill and hang out and see you.
Yeah. That was the thing I think that kept me coming, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about your pick this week.
Okay.
And here is where I would play the trailer for the movie, which is my plan. But the trailer for Alien really doesn't have anything to listen to because it's just like the alarm claxons and screaming and stuff. There's no dialogue and such.
Well, in space, no one can hear you scream. So
right. So it was like, okay, here's the foundation of what I'm going to do. In the very first episode, I can't do it.
Beautiful. So I like that I'm breaking it already.
Oh, yeah. Well, you and several other people that I have lined up are breaking the formula, which is fun. So your pick is 1979 Alien from director Ridley Scott, written by Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shuslett, with a cast, an amazing cast, including Tom Skerritt, Sigourney Weaver, Veronica Cartwright, Harry Dean Stanton, John Hurt, Ian Holm, and Yaphet Kotto. That was my first thought when I was revisiting this is this is a hellacious cast. Like it's right. Like a powerhouse of talent.
Bilbo Baggins, man.
Bilbo Baggins. That's right. And you know, the doctor, because John Hurt goes right on to play the war doctor. And,
right.
Yeah. I mean, among others. So I haven't seen this movie.
That's a lie.
How do you describe this?
That's a lie.
To me? How do you sell me to see that? Yeah, well, it is a lie, but I have not seen this movie. How do you tell me about it?
It is the ultimate movie of suspense, horror, a little bit of total confusion and mystery, wondering what the heck's going on. And I think the thing that really draws me to this movie is that it's not so much about the underdog, but certainly in a world that is kind of loaded with the white man saves the world, you know, genre of movies, which is just about every movie, that doesn't happen in this one. And so you feel like there's actual inclusion and that it's possible to have a different kind of ending.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's an alien.
There's an alien. Well, that was going to be my next question is why is this your choice? You know, all the movies, all of time, what makes this stand out?
You know, I think for me, it's just about it actually finally being relatable. You know, I saw this as a, you know, young teen and, you know, for the first time. And it was much more relatable to me that a chick could survive and have the cat come with her, you know?
I think that's going to answer a question I have later on, but we'll get to that later. Okay. When did you see this? I mean, like, I have a vivid memory of my first time seeing this movie, and I'll share that in a minute. But when did you first see this movie?
I don't remember the first time that I saw it because I've watched it so many times. I think I was 14 or 15, maybe.
Okay. That actually lines up with our family because for me it was 13. Okay. And you're 13, you're old enough to see this now, even though it's rated R, so that's technically mm-hmm. much later. But I remember having a friend over for my birthday and having pizza and watching this movie. And I will tell you that when that chest burster scene occurs, there is nothing worse to be eating than cold pizza.
Oh, that's awful.
But yeah, so I mean, that's if I was like 13 when I first saw it, you being 14, 15, that lines up pretty well. Mm-hmm. Kind of a coming of age for our family, I guess.
Right. I can't tell you what I was eating, but it's probably popcorn.
Probably popcorn.
Yeah.
So, you know, I took copious notes rewatching this again. I don't think, oddly enough, that I have seen this in its entirety since then.
Really?
I've seen some of the other ones quite a few times, but I don't think I've seen this one.
No, I don't even know how many times I've watched it. I got into a huge loop between this movie and Abyss with Ed Harris.
Oh, yeah.
And, like I could just rewatch them for forever till the end of time. So it's almost like Groundhog Day. Like just at least once a year, I'm going to have gone through it again.
Well, and I remember this being one of the first movies you got on DVD because I helped you pick out your first DVD player, and it was a multi-disc player, and you got the set that was available at the time.
I got the four movie set, and I just tried to pretend that the fourth movie didn't exist.
Oh, we'll talk about that more in a minute too, but that's funny. Yeah, so I know this was one of your first DVDs when we got to that technology. So just kind of one of the things I like about this movie, you know, watching it, they make every wrong move at the beginning of the movie. Like everything, if you were in their place, you would not be making these mistakes, or at least we like to think we wouldn't be.
Right.
And yet it's completely justified by the fact that these aren't military.
No.
These are blue collar workers sent out into space. And I think that's a fascinating approach to take to the crew, to put them in that role instead of a military role.
Right. Or like, I mean, even in the world of, you know, like Star Trek, here every role is clearly defined and everybody has an exact protocol. It's not like that at all in Alien. These are just people.
Right.
You know, yeah, they don't have marching orders. They don't have a hierarchy other than who the captain is. That's it.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because they do, because they say that Ripley's in charge. Ripley is third in charge. She says that at the end, that she's the third in charge. And they also talk about the fact that she's in charge when Burke and Dallas are off the ship. And she gets overridden.
Yeah.
When she's in charge, Ash lets them back on the ship, even though she doesn't want to. But there is kind of a hierarchy, but it's definitely not military.
Right. Right. It's not a formal, like it's not treated formally, I guess is the right way. And like you can even just in the very first opening scenes, you know, and you see all the lights kind of coming on in the ship and you see what that like bridge looks like. And it's just so normal and so human. It's not this very stale look to it.
It's interesting that the ship itself and it feels realistic. There's not a particularly sexy aesthetic to it like you have in Star Trek. It's just, it looks very realistic. It looks like, okay, this is functional.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, some of the appeal. And that's why I think, you know, shows like Firefly, you know, and Serenity, like that, it worked because it looked like they really hung out there.
Yeah, I love, I will always love that kitchen table centerpiece on Firefly. I mean, that just gave that show such a feel. But yeah, so as I said, every move they make is wrong, but easy to write off as this is outside their scope of work. I do want to ask you, I guess I'm jumping ahead, I'm not going through the movie in order, but we find out later on that Ash was a last minute replacement by the company. That Dallas had a science officer that he had worked with several times. And then at the last minute, the company replaced him with Ash. And so nobody knows who Ash is at the beginning of the film.
Right.
Do you feel like that meant the company knew they were going to encounter this situation?
You know, stand alone by itself, who knows, maybe not, maybe so. You watch the second Aliens. Yeah, I think that they knew exactly what was going to happen.
So they had just, the mission that they were on didn't really matter. It was irrelevant. They were really being sent out to have this encounter.
Right. They were going to respond to this beacon and they knew that Ash wasn't at risk.
Yeah, well, that's true. I love the you were talking about the opening, you know, feeling lived in. It's also a very slow, methodical style. For the first like 20, 30 minutes of the film, everything is very slow. Everything's very methodical.
It's a false sense of security.
It is. But it also, I think, adds to the suspense because you know this is a movie about encountering an alien. And when you're first going through the ship and you don't know where the crew is, you know, if this is the first time you've seen it, you don't know that the crew's in hypersleep. You're just seeing an empty ship with the lights coming on, and you almost wonder, is that alien going to jump out at you at any given second? And so it kind of builds the suspense to it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you don't understand what's going on just yet. You're kind of just laying this foundation and going, what's going to happen?
Yeah. So they go on their mission. Ripley's in charge. And I feel like she's almost minimized from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
She asks Ash about, is mother finished translating the message yet? And Ash doesn't really care. He's like, well, you go ahead and give it a go. And then when she tries to initiate quarantine protocol, he lets them in.
Right.
And then when she gets in his face about things, he says to her, you do your job, let me do mine. Yes. And it's like, dude, that's what she was trying to do from the get-go. She was trying to do her job, which was don't let them on the ship.
Right. Because that's the smart thing to do.
Right. But it also, that was her job. And I almost feel like a lot of the movie spends time negating her opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's
which, I mean, that's a very, like, basically it's a lot of mansplaining, right? Like, so
right.
Here she is, and she's got all these thoughts and these opinions that maybe would keep them all alive, but nah, don't worry about it. Open the door. You know,
right.
I mean, and I think that's where I said at the beginning, like, I feel like for, you know, as a woman watching it, I feel like it was so much more relatable for me because usually in these movies, the chicks die off or, you know, they just don't really carry a lot of weight. And here she is. She seems like she should carry a lot of weight and they're just not listening.
Have you heard of the Bechdel test?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So when I was watching the movie, I wrote down a comment about the Bechdel test. For our listeners who are not familiar with the Bechdel test, it was conceived in the comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For in 1985, a strip called The Rule by Alison Bechdel. And she has a character in that comic strip talk about she only goes and sees movies that meet three criteria. One, it has to have at least two women in it. Two, they have to talk to each other. And three, they have to talk to each other about something besides a man.
Yes.
And I was watching this movie and I jotted down that this movie wouldn't pass the Bechdel test because Ripley and Lambert almost never talk to each other.
Right. That's very true. I mean, till close to the end.
Till close to the end. What I didn't realize is that comic strip, the character who says that about has to have two women in it who talk to each other about something besides a man, she says, yeah, the last movie I saw was Alien. Like, that's part of the genesis of this concept that Alien is referenced in it as something that does pass it. And I find it interesting because they almost never talk to each other. They have like one brief scene where they converse about how to stop the alien, what they're going to do as far as like the self-destruct and that kind of stuff. There's also a deleted scene in which the two of them talk about Ash. So they're talking about a man. So I almost feel like this movie from that feministic standpoint wouldn't pass the Bechdel test. And yet it's considered part of its genesis.
But they aren't talking about Ash as like he's an acquisition, you know, like they're not talking about him. Like, what do you think Ash thinks? You know, like.
Well, they were talking about him almost sexually in that deleted scene.
Okay. I guess I can see it. I guess I can see it. I don't want to say yes, but
do you feel like this movie passes the Bechdel test?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Nobody's trying to hook up in here. You know what I mean? Like it's purely just survival, and I think that it's treated that way. Even like when they get down to the point where it's just her and Lambert and I forgot the character's name.
Parker.
Yeah. When it gets down to just them, like it's just business at that point. Like you just try to live through it.
Right.
And so far, all the evidence that they've seen is that you don't.
Right. Well, and that's, I find it interesting that the scene where Parker does face off with the alien, Lambert doesn't do anything.
Yeah. She kind of freezes.
And there's a part of me that wanted to scream at the screen, you know, what do something. And there's a part of me that's like, nope, that's pretty realistic.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be terrified.
The other question I wanted to ask you, talk about the feministic standpoint of this, but it almost has a Marxist standpoint to it as well, especially with Parker and Brett, that they're always bitching about equal shares, wanting equal pay.
Mm-hmm.
You have the company referred to. It doesn't have a name at this point in the mythology. It's
right.
Just the company. And it's because you're getting the point of view of the working man, it's kind of being referred to as a negative thing.
Yeah, you definitely. I mean, they don't want to go and do anything unless they're going to get a cut or they're going to get a bonus or, you know, something like that. Like it's purely that they're clearly doing it for the money because they're not doing it because they think there's people involved that need saving.
Right. And I find that, I mean, it's like, and like even that scene where when they land early on and the bottom of the ship has been damaged and Ripley goes down to check on what's going on. And this kind of, I guess, ties to both things I've been talking about. They have all the coolant leaking and blowing in the air and the klaxons and all that stuff going on when she's shouting at them about how long is this going to take. And then as soon as she leaves, they turn it off. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they're trying to have control over something because they feel like they're being dicked around by the company.
Right.
And they don't care about her opinion because they don't want her to tell them how to do their job.
Right. And they yeah, absolutely. Because they don't want to hear it.
Right. I find it interesting. I was reading Harry Dean Stanton, who plays Brett, was didn't want to do this movie.
Really?
Because he didn't want to do sci-fi type movies. And Ridley Scott told him it was more like 10 Little Indians. Which, if you think about it, it kind of is.
Okay.
It's a group of people being picked off one at a time. That's the premise of 10 Little Indians, or now we refer to it as And Then There Was One.
Right.
Or
right.
And Then There Were None. But yeah, I mean, it kind of is.
He did so good. I can't imagine being anybody else being in that role.
Yeah.
I mean.
So the slow, methodical approach the movie allows us to get quite a few jump scares in. Is that something that appeals to you? Or do you get tired of it being the cat after the third or fourth time?
I'm kind of on the fence with that because I'm not a huge fan of just the jump scare for the sake of a jump scare. But when it's important, I think it can be good. So the knowing that you've got the suspense of looking for this alien on the ship, of which they don't know how big it is, you know, they think they're looking for this little chest burster until they find that exoskeleton. So,
well, when it sheds its skin, yeah. And my first thought was, oh shit.
Yeah. Cause you know, it's bigger now. So there's a lot of tension and suspense in that moment. And that's the right moment for a jump scare, I think, because you're expecting something else. You 100%, you're already expecting something horrible is going to happen, but you're not thinking, oh, the cat will scare them.
Right.
So when there's that anticipation, I think it's important. But if it's just, you know, time after time, like some other movies do, it starts to lose its value because nothing's been built upon. It hasn't been earned. So, yeah.
So in this case, you think it's good.
Yeah.
Well, you have the infamous chest burster scene before they find his skin. And I find that scene interesting because without... One of the things I like about this movie is it doesn't hit you over the head with anything. So like you have the chest burster scene and you're getting all of those reactions and the camera never focuses on him. But if you're watching the whole screen, you see how slow Ash is to react to what's going on. Like he's set aside. He's very cool as opposed to, you know, Veronica Cartwright shrieking because she just got splattered with blood in the face and right. Everybody else is freaking out. And Ash is just cold.
I can't say I've ever noticed that.
Yeah, they don't hit you over the head with it. It's very subtle. He's slow to react. It's just pure scientific, and I actually am a little surprised he lets them jettison his body, because you would almost think they would want that for further exploration.
I don't know. I mean, do you want to play along and make it look like you're following along, or do you want to put a stop to it and make them question why you want to keep the body? I don't know. I can see it both ways, I guess. Like I've never noticed that he got up slow. I'm too busy.
Well, it's not that he gets up slow, because they're all on their feet. It's just he's slow to react. He doesn't react the same way everybody else does, which I think is, again, it's just laying that foundation that there's something different about him without hitting the audience over the head with it. And it's laying a nice foundation for what's to come with Ash. So it sheds its skin. We talked about that. And then you have Brett looking for Jonesy, which is what leads to his demise. So it's that damn cat.
Yeah. And his scene where he gets it is absolutely the best, because they do such a good job of him standing there and there's water dripping and the chains are swinging in the air, like whatever these chains are for, we don't know, but there's chains swinging and it's like this tail of the alien just gradually coming down and just blending in so nicely with the chain. Like, it's just perfect.
Right. Right. So then they're going to go look for it in the air ducts and Ripley volunteers to go. And what is she told?
She's told, no, you're not man enough.
Right. Right. Well, she's not told that, but yeah, I mean, that's the underlying idea, I guess. And that was the point that I made the comment about it not passing the Bechdel test, because the two women almost never talk. And again, Dallas goes into the air ducts. And again, if you pay attention to Ash's reaction during that scene while he's being stalked and you have Ripley freaking out about it, mm-hmm. Ash, again, is very cool and cold in that scene. Of course, that then leads to us finding out the truth about Ash.
Right.
Because Ripley's now in charge. It's kind of harder to negate Ripley once she's, you know, in charge.
Right. At the point that she is at the top of the food chain, literally.
Right.
I have to say, the scene with Dallas going through the air ducts and Lambert watching the little blip monitor of where he is, and her just performance in that, of like when they start to realize that the alien's there and it's on the move and they're getting closer and closer and closer. That's the perfect, perfect kind of tension. I think it just builds and builds.
Yeah. She's really good. And it's funny because, you know, I said, what a cast, and Veronica Cartwright hasn't had a major big thing like Alien, like many of the others, but she's done so much little stuff, and it's always that nuanced, really brilliant. I mean, she's a great actress.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look at her IMDb, she's done a ton of stuff, but it's none of it's been like a huge, you know, career defining role. Yeah. But boy, she's a talented actress.
Yeah, I mean, she knows how to make it look realistic, how to sell that.
Yeah. So then we find out about the Ash. My question for you, because maybe you have a different perspective than I do. So Ash is now going to eliminate Ripley. So that's how you get rid of, that's how you negate someone when they're in charge, I guess, is you try to kill them. What the hell is with the rolled up magazine?
I know. Isn't that stupid?
Like, wouldn't she still be able to breathe through the giant hole there?
You would think, like, it's going to be a very slow suffocation.
Yeah, I was just like, I still don't get this.
That's how you know he was broken. He's like, smother her with a pillow, a blanket. Nah, magazine.
Right.
He was on the fritz.
So they talk to him about the perfect organism. And he has that line, I admire its purity.
I admire its purity. Survivor. Unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality.
And it's almost, is he talking about the alien or is he talking about himself?
It could be both, you know. I mean, I take it as the alien for sure. But, I mean, once you know he's an android, he's just as untouchable. He could be programmed for consciousness. He could be programmed for remorse. But he clearly wasn't.
Right. So, it's obviously he's talking about the alien, but it does apply to him just as well, which is, I think, a really interesting approach.
Well, and they do such a good job with that scene that, like, in terms of character, it 100% makes Ripley's distrust of Bishop in the second movie that much stronger, because you saw her firsthand experience. So I think they really built on that scene well.
Well, I was talking to a friend earlier today, because we just saw the latest trailer for the new Terminator movie. And to me, Linda Hamilton in the Terminator movies, especially between Terminator and Terminator 2, is the perfect natural progression of character. Mm. You know, she's a waitress in the first movie, and she's a badass by the time the second movie starts. And yeah, if you found out that that's what was going to happen to your future, you would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Ripley is online with that, that what she is in the first movie and then who she becomes in the second and subsequent movies is also that very natural progression of character. And you're talking about that with, you know, Ash and then with Bishop. Yeah, we see the reason she doesn't trust Bishop, which makes that relationship that they end up having all the more interesting.
Right. Right. I mean, they really do a good job just making that character stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think that lends itself to, like, believability. You want to watch it because she's not the same person at the end of the movie as she was at the beginning. And that's for every one of the movies. She's never the same.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to blow up the ship is what they decide. And they're okay. So she sends Parker and Lambert off to go do their thing. She's going to go ready the shuttle, and she gets to the shuttle and she starts getting ready to prep it. And then she hears Jonesy. So my question is, would you go back for the cat?
Cha-chow.
Not a doubt, huh?
I'm not going to leave that.
Oh, I really thought you would think about it more, but okay.
No, you go back for the cat. I mean, people's houses catch on fire and they run in for their pets. Yeah, you're going to go get them because that cat has got a longer history with all of them. You know that. It's on the ship with them from however long this, you know, mission has begun. Months, maybe. They know this cat. She likes it.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure in the middle of blowing up a ship and trying to escape an alien, I would go back for the cat, but apparently you're certain you would.
You know what, though? Even better in all of that, she didn't even remember it until she heard it.
Right. They weren't even thinking about the cat until, oh, right, you're
crap,
here too.
It's a cat. Okay.
Never mind the fact that you scared the hell out of us twice already and technically caused Brett's death. Yeah.
But it didn't scare Ripley.
Yeah.
And I love there's this weird thing that you get with the moment where you have she gets Jones, and because it's not the cat, it's Jones. She gets little Jonesy into the cat carrier of the future. And then there's that scene where the carrier is sitting there and the alien is there and sees the cat. And clearly the alien doesn't give a crap about the cat. it's not worth killing. It's not going to help it spawn new baby aliens. It just leaves it alone. And I think that's like really smart in terms of how do you create this perfect alien character or species. Yeah, it wouldn't care about the cat at all.
So there's the difference between the aliens and the humans right there, boiled down to whether they'd help the cat or not.
Yeah.
I didn't realize Jonesy was so important.
It's true. I saw a video. I'm gonna go off on a small tangent. There's a video on YouTube where a guy that works with wildlife uses a laser pointer with lions and cheetahs and things like that. They don't care about that red dot, but as soon as he gets to like the smaller wild cats, suddenly they're interested. Because that would be what their prey size is. So I think it's very similar to that. It's that lion doesn't care about a laser pointer. You know, it doesn't
because
think
it's
that small. Exactly. So why
does
the alien care?
That's really interesting.
So
I didn't think about that. We finally get our first really good look at the alien with Parker's death. And it's also the first time that we find a body, which I almost want to know what the difference is there. But apparently there's a deleted scene where you do find the previous dead bodies, but it's not in the main. I didn't watch the director's cut because Ridley Scott has said he still feels like the original is the best presentation of his story.
Yeah, I can't say I've seen that deleted scene at all.
Yeah. So they're going to blow up the ship. So you have these Claxtons going. You have the blowing coolant everywhere. You have the lights flashing. Where else did they think a perfect survivor would go?
Right.
Like, that is so natural. That makes so much sense.
It just is going to get itself out of there and then do whatever it wants. So, yeah,
right.
Go hide in the little cubby.
So a couple things I wrote down about that scene. First of all, the strobe light effect is so effective, and it's just a simple strobe light.
Right.
I mean, it's easy in this day and age of computer enhanced effects to kind of lose sight of just how much you could get done with practical effects.
Right. And I mean, that's more realistic. If, you know, you go into just about any building, if there's a fire alarm that goes off, you get that strobe.
Yeah.
So it's just realistic for what would be on that ship.
The only effect that really took me out of the movie, in fact, you know, I mean, most of the movie holds up really well. The explosion when the Nostromo blows up, that's like the one really dated effect. Almost everything else really still holds up.
You mean the visual of it exploding, or the
Visual
for 5 minutes?
The visual of it exploding is just kind of it's just doesn't hold up very well. Yeah. But for a movie from 1979 to hold up today says a lot about what they accomplished with this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of movies out there that when you rewatch them, they don't.
Right.
So
again, kind of going back to the feministic viewpoint that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. She's on the escape shuttle. Everything is fine. And she strips down.
Right.
Does that bother you at all?
No, because when you first see them, they're getting out of their cryopods and they're in their underwear.
Yeah, and I actually, that was the note I made, was that I said I would almost criticize Sigourney stripping down to underwear, but then considering what John Hurt was wearing in the infirmary.
Yeah.
I mean, she's actually better clothed there.
Yeah, no, that doesn't bother me at all, because she's preparing to go into cryo. She puts Jonesy in the cryo, you know.
Right.
That's she's just getting ready for bed, basically.
Do you think they would have fought over who went in the cryopods if she and Parker and Lambert had all made it onto the shuttle? Like, would Jonesy have gotten a spot?
Well, yeah, of course. Now, they never showed how many cryos there were. You only see the one, so I hope there were two others.
No, there were only two. There were only two on the shuttle. In fact, they specifically said that the shuttle isn't big enough to accommodate all of them, but they just find a way to survive. There's only two cryopods on it.
They just have to sleep in shifts, I guess.
I guess.
I never thought about if they lived.
And you know, Parker would not be happy about having to trade off with a cat.
No.
So then you get your last gotcha. Mm-hmm. The alien, really, if you watch that scene, it's hiding in plain sight.
Oh, yeah, because she's near it and doesn't even see it. And you as the audience, you didn't notice it either.
Right. And that's so brilliant.
And so much about the ship is like tubing and, you know, steam and all this stuff. Like, it just blends in.
Yeah. Can't say I agree with her singing Lucky Star in that, and apparently that was a very expensive choice that Sigourney Weaver made. It wasn't in the script. It was something that Weaver wanted to do, and apparently the rights to the song cost them like a good bit of their budget.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I like the song. I like the song in there, and it's one of those...
I think it makes more sense once you know in the second movie that she had a daughter.
That's what I was going to say. You know,
sorry.
No, you're good. We're thinking alike. yeah, I mean, here she is. She's this maternal character that you didn't realize was this maternal character. And what do you do to calm someone down? You sing to them or you rock them. So yeah, that's where she went.
Yeah. Once you have that second movie, I think it adds a lot more dynamic to her character.
And if you want all the big excitement and the running and the fighting and all that, that's what the second movie gives you, all that. The whole military angle.
Right.
Now, I love about that scene, and I don't know if maybe you're going to mention this or not, but what I love is the big yawn that the alien gives. It's just...
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. When it's laying in there and she's seen it and it just sticks its little mouth out, yawns, and pulls it back in and just gets settled back in for the night. Like, it doesn't even care that she's there. Not in the least.
Well, because it's a survivor, and this is what it's done to survive.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I feel like that's, like, the perfect tension. Here's this massive killing machine, and it's just bored.
Well, that's, I never thought about it that way before. That's interesting.
Well, there you
go. So critics were not kind to this movie when it originally came out.
Really?
Yeah, Roger Ebert originally described it as basically just an intergalactic haunted house thriller.
Okay.
Okay. Let me come back to Ebert in a second, but that was his original thing, was just an intergalactic haunted house thriller. Pauline Kael famously bashed it. She said, "This was a tedious haunted house with a gorilla picture set in outer space. It reached out, grabbed, and squeezed your stomach. It was more gripping than entertaining, but people didn't mind. They thought it was terrific because at least they'd felt something. They'd been brutalized. It was like an entertainment contrived by Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, by the professor of Feelies in the College of Emotional Engineering. Yet there was also a backlash against Alien. People were angry at how mechanically they'd been worked over."
Wow. I'm shocked by that.
Yes, so was I. I really expected Kael to be more behind it, but no, she wasn't. What I find interesting is Ebert later changed his mind about it. So when he wrote about the 30-year release, he said, Alien has been called the most influential of modern action pictures, and so it is, although Halloween also belongs on that list. Unfortunately, the film's influence studied its thrills, but not its thinking. We have now descended into a bog of gotcha movies in which various horrible beings spring on a series of victims, usually teenagers. The ultimate extension of the genre is the geek movie, illustrated by the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which essentially sets the audience the same test as an old-time carnival geek show. Now that you've paid your money, can you keep your eyes open while we disgust you? A few more ambitious and serious sci-fi films have also followed in the footsteps of Alien, notably the well-made Aliens, 1986, and Dark City, 1998. But the original still vibrates with a dark and frightening intensity.
Mm.
So 30 years later, and he sees how different films have come out, he changes his tone on Alien completely.
Wow. That's really interesting to hear. I'm glad, I mean, that he had that thought process when it's in comparison to, you know, Saw.
Right. Right.
It's a different kind of movie.
Yeah. Obviously, you've seen Aliens, and we'll talk about that here in a second. Have you seen Dark City?
No. Mm-mm.
Oh, such a good movie.
I have not seen this.
I'll lend that to you next time I get a chance to see you.
All right.
Because it's phenomenal. So, rank the Alien movies.
Okay. So, I have some different thoughts about it because I want to say just, you know, 1, 2, 3 in order. Uh-huh. The way they come out. But I think the ending of 3 is got to come before the end.
Really?
Of 2. because at the end of 3, she's like making that ultimate sacrifice where she has the chest burster getting ready to come out of her body, and she is rather fall back into like molten lead and hold on to that sucker as it explodes out of her than mm-hmm. let this continue. And I feel like that is such a
You think that's more than get away from her, you bitch?
Yeah, I mean, just because of the ultimate sacrifice, I guess, involved. And I love the ending of 2. I like the ending of all of them. But you've got that moment where you know this thing's getting ready to explode out of you and you actually grab it and keep it. That's the next level.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Okay, so you would go 1, 2, 3, but you didn't mention Resurrection.
No, because I didn't like it. There were things I liked about it. I liked all the weird, like, genetic testing, them trying to make copies of Ripley and failing horribly. I think that was great. I think all the supporting cast, like Winona Ryder's in there, Ron Perlman's in there, like, they do a fantastic job. And Ripley is very believable as this kind of GMO character. I like all of that. Where I draw that line is with that weird alien-human mashup baby thing that she acts like she's the mother of. And I just don't go there. I don't buy that one.
Because you know who wrote Alien Resurrection, right?
No.
Joss Whedon.
Oh, well, that's he screwed up right there.
He actually digs on it in an episode of Angel talking about a character liking all of the Alien movies. Oh, except for that last one.
Yeah, that's where I stand with it. I mean, there's a lot of great things happening in there. They do a really good job on a lot of stuff. But that main plot point, I don't buy.
Okay. And I specifically didn't give you a lot of direction other than rank the Alien movies because I wanted to see what movies you included. So you're not including the AVP movies at all?
That's like a side job. I don't think of that as one of the Alien movies at all.
And you're not including Prometheus or Alien Covenant, the prequels?
Now, I'm going to be honest, I haven't seen Alien Covenant yet.
I haven't either.
Oh, we'll see.
It dawned on me when I was getting prepped for this today. I was like, wait, I still have not seen that.
Now, Prometheus was good. I did find that enjoyable. But when it comes to like the Ripley universe of Alien, I don't include it. And when I think of Alien, I think of the Ripley universe. Probably why I didn't mention AVP. Mm-hmm. Just because she's not in that.
So you like Prometheus?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I mean, it seems a little more horror side than slow build and introspection and stuff like that. But, you know, I didn't mind it as a story of the space jockeys.
Okay. I you know, watching this, the original Alien movie, I was like, boy, it suffers from that same problem that kind of the Star Wars prequels have, which is the technology that's appearing on screen doesn't match up with the technology that's appearing on screen of what's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Prometheus, the technology they use in Prometheus is way ahead of the technology that they have, you know, in Alien.
Right. Right. And that is one of those things where, I mean, this is supposed to be like in the future somewhere. And like that, the beginning of in Aliens, when you see like the kind of Wyland colonies, that kid's riding a big wheel, you know?
Right.
We don't have that kind of stuff anymore. We're a little more advanced than giant plastic thing.
So not I am surprised you picked. I am surprised you picked original Alien because most people do tend to think of Aliens as the better movie in the saga. But you're also saying you put Alien above it,
right? Because you know the one thing about it is that Aliens is more the military sci-fi,
right?
And the first movie is more of a suspense thriller, and I find that the way that it builds is done so well. And like you said, the very beginning, you kind of have to tell somebody like, just sit with it for the first 20 minutes. I promise it's gonna get there. You know, like it is such a nice slow build. By the time you get to the end, like you don't even remember what the beginning started out as because it's, you've gone all the way up to 11 with it. But you know, if you want to just shoot a bunch of aliens, that's in the second movie. And you can do right. that. They're not running from them as much as they're running towards them.
Well, that's, yeah, okay. I mean, they're definitely running from them after a while.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, but the stuff that Aliens does right is like when they look up into the ceiling and here's like 30 of them climbing towards them. Like, that's perfectly done because you finally get to see more than one alien at a time. And it's such this dark cluster. You still don't get a chance to really view them, but you know there's a ton of them coming towards you.
Right.
And then you have the queen, naturally. So that's like an interesting piece to kind of close that off. Because in the beginning of Alien, like there's all those pods, all those eggs in the room. Like, you know more than one of those.
Which apparently was originally only supposed to be like three or four. And then Ridley Scott was like, no, there needs to be more.
More eggs. Yeah.
Right.
It's a whole room of them. Like,
yes.
But so it kind of helps explain, okay, there was a queen there at some point. So where'd she go?
You know? Right. Right. All right. So the algorithm says, taking a look at several different websites, other movies you might like if you like this one.
Okay.
We already talked about Dark City. You've not seen that.
Right.
The rest of these, I'm going to assume you've seen. Terminator.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I want to know where that connection comes from. The Thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And oddly enough, The Shining.
that's very strange. Not as strange as Indiana Jones, but that's very strange. Maybe it's the suspense.
I guess.
It's just a haunted house flick. So, yeah.
But that's according to the algorithm. People who liked this movie, those are other movies you might like. And apparently you've seen all of them. So there you go.
Definitely. If I think The Thing is probably the closest matched up to those because it's the same kind of man versus wild scenario. And it's something that you don't know and you don't understand. And you're just trying to live through it. And you got Wilford Brimley in there. So
I'm better now. I want to come back inside.
Yeah.
And eat my oatmeal.
Diabetes.
All right. So before we finish, you got to have a little pop quiz.
Mm-hmm.
And see how well you know your alien information. All right.
I'll try. I haven't watched anything this year.
All right. So, no, this is all about Alien. This is all just about Alien. All right. So, number one, the Xenomorph, which is what they refer to the alien as, has a surprisingly small amount of actual screen time. How much time out of the film's 117 minutes does the creature appear on screen? A, 15 minutes, B, 10 minutes, C, 6 minutes, or D, 4 minutes?
I was going to say 6. So I'm going to go with that.
Wrong.
Is it four?
4 minutes. It actually only has 4 minutes of screen time, and it doesn't appear until an hour into the film.
That's fantastic.
Which I think contrasts really well with what you were saying about aliens, you know, opening the hatch and having, you know, 30 aliens there. Here, you only have 4 minutes of actual screen time for the alien.
That's beautiful. And so much horror.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Director Ridley Scott was open about his influences in creating Alien. Which of the following movies was not an inspiration? A, Star Wars: A New Hope. B, 2001: A Space Odyssey. C, The Birds. Or D, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
2001.
That's incorrect.
Is it Star Wars?
No, he said flat out that Star Wars, 2001, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre were his key influences in
Not
making this movie.
Not the birds?
Not the birds.
Come on now. He's just lying.
All right. Which was not a casting possibility, but probably occurred in an alternate universe?
Paul Reiser.
A, Veronica Cartwright as Ripley. B, Mark Hamill as Dallas. C, Meryl Streep as Ripley. Or D, Harrison Ford as Dallas.
Harrison Ford for sure.
Nope, he was offered the role of Dallas and turned it down. Oh. Mark Hamill
picture
was
him
the,
doing that.
Yeah, Veronica Cartwright originally read for Ripley.
Wow.
Meryl Streep read for Ripley, and Harrison Ford was offered the role of Dallas.
I would totally watch the Alien spoof with Meryl Streep as Ripley.
All right, last one. Ridley Scott has said he feels this movie takes place in the same universe as what other Ridley Scott movie? A, Blade Runner. B, Legend. C, The Martian. Or D, his 1984 Apple commercial.
Oh, my Jesus. You know, I want to say The Martian, but no, I don't think so. So that's probably going to be right. So let's go with the commercial.
No, Blade Runner. He feels like this movie and Blade Runner take place in the same universe, that they could have gotten back from their trip and gone for a drink and run into Rick Decker.
Well, any movie can take place in the same universe as anything else if you change the time period.
Well, and it's kind of interesting. Obviously it takes place in the same universe as the Predator movie since they've had the AVP stuff. So you have what, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 movies in this, and then what, 4 Predator movies?
Yeah, and the Predator movie is just getting better.
And then if it takes place in the Blade Runner universe, then you add 2 more movies there. And then Blade Runner is referenced in, I think, Soldier. So that's another. So you have like 11, 12 movies all connected based on that assumption that they take place in the same universe.
Wow. I don't know about that.
All right. So not so good on the pop quiz, but, you know, hey, it's still one of your favorite movies. That's why it's a pop quiz. All right, Margaret, where can people find you?
I am available on Instagram. Just about everything is at M. Telsch Williams. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I've got some books available on Amazon. Same thing, just M. Telsch Williams.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know the old podcast audience really missed you when you left, and I'm sure they'll be happy to hear your voice one more time.
Well, good. Yeah, because I'm still here.
Yeah, check out some of her books. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So, what do you think? How would you rank the Alien movies? Would you save the cat? And is Ripley and Lambert's conversation really significant enough to pass the Bechdel test? Let me know what you think. You can find Have Not Seen This on Twitter at Have Not Seen This, or on Facebook at Have Not Seen This Podcast, or email me at havenotseenthis@gmail.com. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to the show so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes, including next week's show, which focuses on a 2007 comedy I intentionally skipped out on when it hit theaters, but have really come to appreciate since I had to watch it for the show. This podcast is available on Google Play and Apple Podcasts, or you can use the RSS feed to subscribe through whatever podcatcher you prefer. Positive ratings and reviews are always welcome, although I'd appreciate it more if you just helped spread the word and help me build up some listeners. Thanks to Chris Talent for our wonderful theme song, and thanks to Margaret Telsch Williams for providing this week's conversation. Hey, maybe you have a movie you'd like to talk about, one that means something to you, or you're particularly astonished when you discover people have not seen. Come be a guest on the show. Shoot me an email telling me a little about yourself and the movie you'd like to discuss at havenotseenthis@gmail.com, and we'll try to get you set up for a future episode. Until next week, I'm Rafe Telsch, and this has been Have Not Seen This.